the Empire podcast this week. We're live at the Edinburgh Film Festival. Hey! Look at that. Just like we rehearsed. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire podcast. It's recorded in front of a live studio audience, just like all those great sitcoms, Friends, Frasier, Seinfeld, Mrs. Brown's Boys. We're here at the wonderful Film House, of course, right in the heart of Edinburgh's cultural quarter. You can tell it's cultural because there's a Nando's across the street. For our second live podcast, and we're very, very excited. Over the next 2 hours or so, you're going to get the usual movie news, reviews, and nonsense. Plus, we have two very special guests. Mr. Frodo himself, Elijah Wood, will be here, and the man who was the original, and some say best, Hannibal Lecter, local legend Brian Cox. But just like Agnes Brown, I can't do this alone on medical grounds as much as anything. So please welcome my very own boys and girl. First up is our podcast editor, a man whose love of train spotting is so great he models his hair after Kevin McKidd's and is found to track down the world's worst toilet while he's here. Clue, it's in the Empire apartment. It's Ali Plum! Hey! You. Next up, we have our art house guru, a man who feels at home here. He actually lived in Edinburgh for a while, so he never ceases to tell us. He went to university here. He graduated with a first in subtitling for The Utterly Miserable. Please welcome Phil Desemlian.
That's my good.
Last but not least, we have our geek queen, a woman who, like me, has Celtic blood running through her veins and, you know, a little bit of hips and hearts as well. That's fun for the locals. She used to be a tour guide in the city for one day only. She was fired for complaining Edinburgh Castle didn't have enough dragons. It's Helen O'Hara! How are we all? You're good? All good? All good?
God.
You're all good?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
good?
We're
good. That's good. That's very good. I'm very glad to hear that. Okay, first up, we're going to tackle the week's movie news. Now, it's recorded on Tuesday, this podcast. You ordinarily be recorded on a Thursday, so we actually have some movie news to talk about. But luckily, in a quirk of fate I like to call Bastard's Law, what happens is Hollywood waits until the Empire podcast goes up live on a Friday, and then they release great movie news. Because they're bastards, basically. So last week, the news hit after we went up that Rian Johnson, director of Brick and Looper, and the other one no one ever talks about because it's actually that good, The Brothers Bloom, is going to direct and write, in that order, Star Wars Episode 8. So what do we make of this? What do we make of this news?
What do we make? We're excited. We're pro Rian Johnson. He is very good. Those two films that you mentioned, I don't remember a third, were both excellent.
It's not that bad. It's got Ruffalo.
It's fine.
It's good. It's
good. Ruffalo, yeah.
It's just not,
it's not as good. Yeah. And obviously his work on Breaking Bad was spectacularly good also. Ozymandias is one of his.
So
he is definitely a good person. He is a person we want to be making more and more films. Now he's writing and directing Episode 8. He's also apparently at least doing a treatment for Episode 9, so the expectation is that might possibly turn into a gig for Episode 9 as well. Who knows? But it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Now, when he was in on the podcast, you may remember, here's what he said, for those of you who don't. He was, at that point, writing, or supposed to be writing, his next project. He was really excited about it, plugging away on it. He said it was vaguely cyberpunk, kind of, but that's a bit of a misdirect, but that's not a purposeful misdirect, just a very different sci-fi from Looper. No, I'm not going to be a conspiracy theorist and say he was writing Star Wars all the way back then, but I'm going to call it and say he was writing Star Wars all the way back then. I mean, it could be, or it could be that, you know, that totally didn't work out and he couldn't figure out the rules of time travel or whatever it was he was playing with and decided to drop it and do Star Wars instead because, hey, Wookiees.
Or he just changed all the names. He just did a find and replace. Yeah. Oh, this is a great Star Wars script. Shit. Guys, what do you make of this?
You don't think he went back in time and told himself?
It's unlikely.
It's unlikely.
It's unlikely.
Can we rule it out?
I love him because he is a big fan of old-fashioned cameras, and I'm that kind of hipster prick. And he came in with this camera and was taking lots of snaps of us. So on his old-fashioned, he was wasting real film on us. Photos of like me and Helen going, "Oh, you make good films." Apart from that one,
that is our actual photo face as well.
He's got a really fun personality. He seems quite reserved, but I don't know. It's a real shot in the arm for Star Wars. I'm encouraged even more about this than I was before.
Yeah.
If he's doing both as well, like if he is possibly doing outline for the next one, just sign me up. Like that kind of, you know, overarching plot. Yes, I love a bit of that.
But I kind of like the idea that this trilogy will follow the original trilogy. I believe there was another trilogy, but I don't know.
No, I don't think so.
If that can be confirmed.
Is that the one with the Brothers Bloom in it?
I believe it was, yeah.
Yes, Indiana Jones 4.
You know, and each of those movies had a different director, and I quite like the idea that Episode 9 will have a different director as well. So that could be quite cool. Mm. But yeah, he is awesome. He's got a really interesting sensibility. And I'm kind of scared by how right all the choices Disney seem to be making on Star Wars thus far. Are they? You know, they're making, you know, J.J. Abrams, good director, Josh Trank, good director, Gareth Edwards, good director, and Rian Johnson.
You think they're softening us up?
What?
They're all
Max Rebo solo tales.
Well, no, I'm thinking they're softening us up, and then the next director they announce
is going to be,
is going to be
Brian LaFant.
Yeah, Uwe Boll.
Yeah, he'd be amazing.
I just want there to be a world where... And by the way, this is a record. First 5 minutes we mentioned Breaking Bad. For the Empire podcast, that's incredible.
We haven't even mentioned Event Horizon or Evil Dead 2 yet, so there's still time,
wait
guys.
For Chris. Absolutely.
Yep, if you're playing the drinking game.
I would say, if there is a world where Bryan Cranston could be a Sith Lord... I just imagine. I'm not going to spoil you by doing my impersonation of Bryan Cranston being Darth Vader, but imagine.
I am the one who force chokes.
There you go.
You haven't seen it. I know Star Wars is not your thing because it's got color in it, but
is it? There are subtitles, right?
This is true.
Some of it's in foreign languages. I love Star Wars. I love Rian Johnson because I got to fly to New York to spend 5 minutes talking to him about Looper, which was the ultimate jolly. I think he's a really gifted storyteller, and I think the films that he's done, Brick especially, Brothers Bloom was got a little bit caught up in its own kind of...
Wait, do we not like that?
Yeah, you think we've not sort of jumped that?
No, we haven't.
Sorry, Ryan.
I feel sorry for Brothers Bloom. I've given it a kick in unfairly.
Nice fellas.
Do you think so?
Yeah, they're nice guys. Yeah. Really nice guys. Anyway.
But yeah, I'm totally excited about this. I kind of wonder with these guys, they're all making a massive leap from, I mean, with the exception probably of Gareth Edwards, from, you know, smaller kind of films that they can put their creative stamp on to something much, much bigger. I'd be interested in what that process is like and how someone like Rian Johnson can be sort of slightly protected and nurtured from, you know, maybe the studio heavies, you know. But if he's given his sort of creative free rein, I think it's going to be excellent. I would love it if there was no exchange of ideas. And he just wrote the script for the next Star Wars film, having no idea what happened in this one.
Can you imagine? It'd be like, you know,
it'd be one of those games where you draw the bits of the human body and you just...
Rian Johnson goes to Gareth Edwards, sir.
He's dead.
So, I'm killing Chewbacca. It's like, well, my movie is a Chewbacca movie. And why isn't there a Chewbacca biopic? Honestly, he's the best one.
I know something about his family, and there's a...
What's happening? That's really sinister.
Well, it actually is. The holiday special, describe.
Come on, guys!
That guy!
Come on. Who can name all of the family? No, don't.
Well, don't. There's Lumpy.
Chumpy.
Testy. And Corduroy.
But this reminds me, I know I've mentioned this before, but Bryan Singer, I remember asking him when he was doing promotion, the press tour for Jack the Giant Slayer. He's a guy who wasn't brain trusting anything with X-Men Days of Future Past. It was amazing. I just said to him, so, you know, have you been in touch with the guys for the Wolverine to make sure this connects properly with Days of Future Past? Nope.
Not really.
Suck it. No.
He didn't go, shit.
Exactly the same thing happened. The continuity of the X-Men movies is notoriously tangled. I was on set of First Class.
Were you on set?
Yes, I was on set of First Class, Helen. Yes, I was. Matthew Vaughn said, yeah, so you got, you know, you're like Emma Frost in this, but there was an Emma Frost in X-Men Wolverine. Yeah, don't give a shit. Don't care. And he literally genuinely did not give a shit. And that was great because it actually freed him up a little bit creatively. So maybe Singer feels the same way.
Three people's names we've mentioned so far. Brian Cox, Elijah Wood, and Rian Johnson.
That's right.
I don't know why you're clapping, you pervert.
This is why we're all sitting down, frankly, because this is the most erotically charged podcast we've ever done.
No, it's not.
It really
number
is.
32 was off the chain. We've accidentally mentioned a Marvel movie, which I'm going to use to segue into my news.
Ooh, nice segue.
Now, this isn't actually a movie as such. It's Netflix. You know Netflix. It's the Daredevil Hell's Kitchen story, which is going to evolve into the Defenders, which will be the Avengers for the Hell's Kitchen. So four characters from Daredevil's world, now that that's back in the hands of Marvel, they're teaming up with Netflix and they're making this grand master plan, which is exciting because they're doing something rather different, not just the same old stuff. Not that it's getting old. Honest, I love it. Empire. So we have casting news. We already know that Matt Murdock, Daredevil, He's Charlie Cox, and we know that Kingpin will be Vincent D'Onofrio.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Was that terrible or just bad?
No, it's fine.
No, it's good.
Okay, great. Now we have a new casting announcement, but not the name of the character. She, will be playing. It is Rosario Dawson.
Ooh.
Who is very much
just me.
Great actress, beautiful lady, and I think a little bit of extra excitement for this project, which I was already just fascinated by. We're not sure who she's playing. Any guesses? Probably a superhero.
I'd imagine so.
She is a huge comic book nerd, as if you didn't find her attractive enough already, Chris. She's a comic book nerd and a gamer, and
Does she like FIFA?
I'm not going to say yes, because I think if I did, you might collapse.
So that's the thing that's happening. I think it's just more encouraging that it's managing to attract such, it's going to come across badly, great talent. But it's good.
Well, but this, if you say it that way.
Well, how are you? No, I just look at your face as your eyelids flick up. Great talent? That's better.
Okay, that's much better, yeah. Okay, interesting.
So that's all I've got.
Yeah, that's good. Phil, what have you got?
I have news of Sylvester Stallone, who's promising to make No Country for Old Men his way, Rambo 5. Apparently. I think the No Country for Old Men reference is because it's kind of set on the Mexican border and he's quite old. But beyond that, I don't know if there's any great kind of bead that you can draw between those two. But this is a project that's been, I don't know if anyone here saw the last Rambo in 2008, I think. But yeah. It didn't get great reviews, but it did make enough money to kind of keep this project kind of on the boil. Although having said that, in 2010, Stallone said that he was about 99% sure that he was going to do what he did with Rocky and just, it was going to come full circle and that was it and it had been done. A couple of years later, he decided that he was dying to do it, apparently. So if anyone can guess what happened in 2011 that involving his bank statement, I imagine. This is now something that's apparently been picked up and going to go into production. Rumors are that the story revolves around a girl being abducted and Rambo crossing the border to get her back and taking on Mexican cartels and Tuco-like characters. I think Rambo's kind of started strong and has kind of nosedived ever since.
I mean, I think the last one was slightly better than maybe we'd seen.
Is that the one where he brought democracy to Burma, didn't he?
But he also cut off a dude's head by killing everyone with a single stroke of his knife.
Who saw that Rambo film? My God, it was violent. It's probably the most violent mainstream movie I've seen in a long, long time, and I've seen Punisher War Zone, which came out the same year. It was extraordinary. It was blood, heads severed, arms were ripped off and used to beat the severed heads with. It was just overkill.
It's not technically Rambo 4. It's actually Hot Shorts Part Deux, Part Deux.
Yeah.
And there is one bit where he fires a chicken at a Burmese terrorist. It's great.
And more films should have that. Not enough
maybe
chicken arrows.
Yeah.
Those terrorists were vegetarian, so he was really sticking it to them.
Oh,
yeah. On several levels. Good old Rambo. Good old Sly Stallone.
Do you reckon Rambo would ever go to Nando's?
Pollos Hananos.
Yes, I think so.
Yes, I think he would.
Okay, that's it.
I think he would. Good. Thanks for coming, guys. Now we've solved that great question. We're going to do a shameless plug now because, as chance would have it, it's New Empire Week. You guys all came here. Thank you for coming. You all have Old Empire. We don't like Old Empire anymore. It's gone. It's off sale. We like New Empire, new shiny empire that Helen is holding up with the Guardians of the Galaxy. That's our subscriber's cover. We're going to discuss it and force you all at gunpoint to buy it. So what's in it? What's in this month's Empire, Helen?
The one with Guardians of the Galaxy on the cover.
That's the one.
You know what? Inside is... I was on set of Guardians of the Galaxy, Chris.
Oh, for the love of God.
So anyway, there's the set report.
Endless name dropping.
Basically, yes, where I hung out with Rocket Raccoon and Groot and some other people who were actually there in person. Basically, this is Marvel's team of underdogs teaming up to become heroes. So that leads off our Future of Film Month. The idea is we're looking at the future of cinema, led by, you know, space critters. So we've got Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which pushes some boundaries in terms of VFX, in that you can now do essentially what James Cameron did with Avatar, but outdoors. You don't need the volume anymore.
That's true. None of us are actually here. We're all played by Andy Serkis, who's out in the car park in a really, really skin-tight leotard.
He is.
He's getting me horribly wrong.
Horribly wrong.
We also looked at, speculated as the living room and cinema of the future, what those are going to look like. We looked at young adult sci-fi in the form of Maze Runner, which I believe, was that an Ali joint?
Let's say it was, it wasn't. It was. Let's say it was. It looks great.
It does.
What's it about, Ali?
Well, there's this maze. I could actually tell you if you want. You don't want.
That's fine.
Yeah, Maze.
Yeah.
It's got great talent in it.
Great talent.
And in a future-y thing, we also have Jupiter Ascending. Which, even though it's not out for a little while yet.
Because we could see into the future and we knew it would be pushed back. Which is why that's in the issue. But there are other things as well. There's a great Sith visit on from Hercules. Our reunions specialist and occasional pod contributor, Nick Desemelian, reunited the people behind the first two Gremlins movies. So we have Joe Dante, Zach Galligan, the great Dick Miller, Rick Baker and Chris Wallace, who did the special effects for both the movies. We reunited them, did a great photo shoot with them. That's a fantastic little feature. You should, actually big feature, you should check that one out as well. And there's tons of other stuff in there. Jon Favreau is this month's pint of milk, and his arse, oh Jesus.
Oh dear.
I went Hollywood. I won't give away, I didn't actually see it firsthand, but he assures me it's quite hairy. Quite hairless, actually. No, hairless, it's quite hairless. It's quite hairless.
In case you're counting, that's four with Dick Miller. So, ooh. Four.
Oh. Huh. I've just read the answer.
And there's Matthew Vaughn on the Secret Service. There's a Luca Foxcatcher. There's set visits from Zach Braff's Wish I Was Here and Begin Again, which has Mark Ruffalo in it, who, of course, was in The Brothers Bloom. Everything is circular here. And that is the movie news done and dusted, because I can just see off stage. Our first interviewee has arrived. So Helen and I are going to leave the stage. Phil and Ali will remain. But first, I'll do a nice big intro. There aren't many actors who could justifiably be called legends at the ripe old age of 33, but our first guest more than deserves that tag. He made his debut memorably as Video Game Boy in Back to the Future Part 2 and became one of the finest young actors around, with turns in the likes of The Faculty, Radio Flyer, and The Ice Storm. Recently, he's been exploring his darker side in the likes of Maniac, Grand Piano, and Sin City, but he's best known for a trilogy of small independent films about a group of hobbits trying to throw a ring into a volcano. He's here in Edinburgh with his new film, Set Fire to the Stars, which he plays a budding American poet assigned to shadow the great Dylan Thomas. Will you please welcome the heart of the fellowship, Mr. Elijah Wood?
Thanks, y'all.
Oh, complicated.
Now, if you're done clapping for me, I would like to point out we are sitting on tables which are about 3 foot away, and Elijah's taking a photograph because you guys are so good looking. Well done. Great news. It feels like we're about to interview you and not for, you know, media purposes.
Uh-huh.
What makes you think you're worthy of a position at Empire?
I love film. I'm extremely passionate about film. I don't know if I'm much of a writer, but I'm extremely passionate, so I feel like I'm good for this job, whatever.
How's your transcribing?
Great.
Great. Just say great.
Great.
Great talent. My first question, this movie's about...
Does feel like a job interview.
Doesn't
a little
it?
Bit. Yeah.
I'm a bit nervous, clammy palms. This is a film where you play, obviously, an American character and Dylan Thomas, who apparently is Welsh. And we're in Scotland, which is Scottish.
That's where we are right
That's
now.
That's where we are right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, so this is Scottish.
This is Scottish. How good is your Welsh accent?
Thankfully, I didn't have to have one, and I imagine it wouldn't be great. Welsh is a funny accent, yeah.
I find it infectious. Were you not on set finding yourself getting a little bit sing-song every once in a while?
Yeah, maybe it bled through a little bit.
Yeah. Because you shot this partly in Swansea.
South Wales, yeah.
But also Lahan, which is where...
He lived, where Dylan Thomas lived in the boathouse, So we went to Lahan on a weekend, Cal and I. We did a little Dylan Thomas pilgrimage. It's great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. Did you go to the little shed where it's all of his...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
his writing effects are all there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like he never left.
Yeah, it's a little creepy.
It's interesting, the ghost of him was sort of following us the whole movie in a way. Because we shot in the No Name Bar where he used to drink.
A lot.
And there was a cafe that we turned into a diner that he used to eat breakfast at. So it was kind of, you know... But funny, because we were shooting it for the United States. It's supposed to be New York. Swansea as New York.
When I think of New York, I think of Swansea.
Right? It's 100%. It's like a sister city in Wales. Sure.
Did you know Dylan Thomas's work pretty well before that? A lot of people know it perhaps best from the Richard Burton, those famous Richard Burton kind of audio recordings of Under Milkwood.
Right.
You hadn't come across... So what was the hook for you to take the role?
The hook was the script, really, which is interesting because the script, you know, on paper, it's a two-hander. It's a character piece about a guy who brings this famous poet to the United States and he's sort of taken on more than he's bargained for, and ultimately the relationship that they have and develop over the course of those 7 days. So on paper, that could be, I don't know, it could be sort of stale, it could be like overly historical or feel like a biopic, but it moved off the page. It was so electric, and it sort of had this sort of jazzy punk rock vibe to it. And I was just intrigued by the characters and intrigued by the piece, and it was kind of an exciting thing to want to jump into. I also was really intrigued by the fact that it was a character piece. I hadn't really done anything quite like that in a while. It was kind of like itching to just jump into something that was, you know, a couple of actors playing these characters and detailing this relationship. And the fact that Andy Goddard wanted to make the movie, shoot it in black and white, for it to have this sort of impressionistic style. He mentioned With Nail and I in our first meeting, and I was like, you fucking had me at that movie. It's one of my favorite films. So there were all these kind of elements that, you know, beyond the script that sort of served to really make it very attractive.
We were going to ask you about With Nail and I, because Phil and I are probably the biggest With Nail and I fans in the office.
On this table.
It's such a great film.
It's such a great film. What quotes do you find yourself crowbarring into general conversation? There's one that you're not going to say, I think.
Bring me some of the bring me cake and some of the finest wine available to humanity. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one. That one sticks out.
On the regular, even if you're not on a cake
show. Sure,
shop.
Yeah, why not?
Right here, right now.
It can apply to any situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that film is so brilliant.
It's incredible. Have you been to the location where they shot it?
No.
Oh, wow. Well, after this, we'll get you in a cab. You'll go all the way.
To the Lake District.
12 hours.
Yeah. Just send Elijah. He's got commitments.
Well, actually, no, that is not true. Penrith is the town that they shot.
Where the tea shop is.
Yes, yes. I've been to Penrith.
Oh, great.
So, and you didn't go into a tea shop and order the finest wines known to
humanity. I didn't actually, no.
And then drunkenly stumble out and into a big Bentley.
I did not. Ugh. Do you know Richard E. Grant had never been drunk prior to that film?
No.
This is a fact.
No.
Okay, you've got the job at Empire.
All right. Not bad. Not bad. But prior to that film, he had never been drunk in his life, which is really hard to imagine.
And then he had Paint Stripper, and then...
And I think the story goes that he got drunk prior to shooting once to have had the experience, and then that was it. And that provided the information that he needed to perfectly play a drunk person.
Yeah.
That is very difficult as an actor. I've been down that road and... with, I don't know, middling success, but he is extraordinary in that film as a drunk person. It's great.
As a perfume ponce who's now making perfume.
Right.
I wanted to ask about kind of unusual bit of promotional tie-in for this movie. Okay. Dylan Thomas, where you actually introduced the BBC's coverage of the Six Nations rugby.
Right.
By reciting Dylan Thomas.
Yes.
And I wonder before you did that whether you got the full explanation of the game of rugby from anyone.
I'd seen a rugby match before.
You'd seen a rugby.
I'd seen a rugby. I'd been to the rugby. I'd actually seen the All Blacks play Australia, which is a pretty heavy rivalry. Go All Blacks or Australia, depending on where.
How did that come about?
What's that?
How did that come about?
We were just finishing production, and they knew that we were filming it and that we were in town, and that game was coming up. And I guess they had had another actor do it before, and so they asked if I would, recite a poem. I was excited about it, but I also didn't really understand the significance beyond the fact that, you know, X million people watched that particular game, so I suppose that was enough. But, I don't know. Was it all right?
Good job.
Yeah,
good
I also job. Sort of thought, like, maybe I'm not the person to be reciting Dylan Thomas. Like, it sort of felt kind of inappropriate. It should have been Kellen, really, but there you go.
Oh, well. This movie has, as its tagline, never meet your heroes. What heroes have you met that have disappointed you horribly? And what do you say to people who see you in the street and pass out because you're you, and you do you tell them to just say, look, I told you, it's on the tagline of the film, never meet your heroes.
I've actually never been terribly disappointed.
Wow, allow us to rectify that.
I don't know. I've never had that experience of meeting someone that I had great reverence for and had expectations that they would be wonderful people to, and it turned out that they weren't. I don't know. I feel like I've had relatively realistic expectations of everyone that I've met, and I've not yet been disappointed.
Let me rephrase it.
Which is kind of great.
Which people have nonplussed you?
What exactly do you mean by that?
I was going to say, if you've never been overimpressed or underimpressed by anybody, is there anybody that's just made you feel, huh?
I don't know. I think I'm always, you know, when I get a chance to meet other actors or film directors, I'm always enthusiastic because it's people that I whose work I admire. So I don't know if I'm ever nonplussed. You know what? I'm mainly not nonplussed by musicians.
Ah.
I'm far more excited in some ways to meet musicians than I am actors because it's the world that I work in, which isn't to say that I'm not impressed to meet certain people because I certainly am, but I'm more often than not super impressed to meet musicians.
You're a big Franz Ferdinand fan, I gather.
I liked their first record.
I just thought, you know,
the Franz Ferdinand's a good band.
Yeah.
And they're a good band. And they're local, right? They're from,
exactly.
They're from Scotland, so yeah. The Vaseline's are coming out with a new record.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty wild.
That'll do. Mm-hmm.
It's cool.
We
like the Vaseline's.
Yeah.
Maguire, good. Should we keep talking about
it? Yeah, keep going.
Scottish bands.
This is the 10th anniversary of one of my favorite films, and I think quite a lot of people's favorite films, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, in which you work closely with Mark Ruffalo, obviously, in a lot of your scenes.
Yeah.
And Kirsten Dunst, obviously.
Yeah.
Were you there for the famous underpant dance sequences in that movie?
I missed it because it's when I leave.
So oh, okay, right.
I'm not in the room.
Unfortunately. Damn.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
I only intended, obviously.
What do I remember? Nice. Man, it was such an extraordinary experience. I would have done anything on that film. I remember when I first heard about it. I mean, seriously, because I was such a huge fan of Kaufman's work as a writer and Michel Gondry as a director. Because I'd seen all of Michel Gondry's music videos and I'd seen Human Nature. And I just loved everything that he did. So I first heard about the film and I was like, fuck it, I don't even need to read it. I'll do like catering or whatever. Like, I just want to be a part of whatever these two people are doing. It was so exciting. And the script is so beautiful. And I think it's kind of the most emotional thing that Kaufman had done. Because so much of Kaufman's work it's so original, but it's so cerebral. Which isn't to say that it's cold, but it's not entirely emotional. And I found that it captured something about being in a relationship and about love lost and the sort of panic of trying to get it back that was just so real, despite the fact that it was happening in this very cerebral, kind of surreal way. And to get to work with Michelle was just insane. It was awesome. So much fun. And Kate Winslet. Yeah. Kate Winslet.
I know. Yeah, should we do some questions from you guys?
You
bloody guys. That's an excellent me. That's really good. Who wants to ask a question? Please put your hand up if you'd like to, and then you can ask it. And there'll be a microphone in front of your mouth.
Two steps.
You can do it, Guy.
Hi there. I was just wanted to ask a quick question. You worked with Rooster Teeth on Red vs. Blue in their season 10.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know how you felt that new kind of genre was coming on. Like, because it's web-based content, which is not really the mainstream, and how that kind of experience was for you, and how you think it's going to develop in the future.
That's a good question. That company is, you know, they're about to start financing or funding their first feature film.
Laser Team.
Well, it shows that, you know, that there's real power to building a community. I think that's what they've done really well. Like, they've created content and then galvanized a community around it. And built up this incredible fan base to the point where Rooster Teeth has their own convention now in Austin, Texas every year. To be honest, I don't know Rooster Teeth that well. I don't pay attention so much to the content, but I know them, like Bernie Burns, who runs the company, I know him through friends of mine in Austin, and I have a place in Austin, I spend a lot of time there. So it was sort of like a friend to friend, hey, do you want to be a part of this thing? And I knew of it just the Red versus Blue thing, because I was, for a while, a real fan of Halo and playing the game. It kind of lost me after Halo 3, to be honest.
Yeah.
A little. Halo 2 is where I stopped. But anyway, it was a fun thing to be a part of. And I think, you know, we're seeing more and more content from the internet actually be turned into sort of viable, like almost television content. And there are so many avenues now for like television distribution. So I sort of feel like, you know, they've always been saying for the longest time that eventually, you know, that'll be a monetizable, like, real place for people to make content that'll be taken seriously. Because the longest time, if it was, like, web-based content, it wasn't taken seriously as an art form. And it seems like that the tide is sort of shifting, which is cool.
It's all thanks to Grumpy Cat as well.
Grumpy Cat, of course.
Doing it all the way. And speaking of tiny, tiny independent productions, what can we ask you about The Hobbit?
You can ask me anything. I don't know that much about it, but you can.
There must be a joy to that with people just going, go on, you know, spill us a secret. Nothing. Got nothing.
I kind of don't have anything. I know how it ends.
Whoa.
that is actually a secret I do hold. So I do know that. And it's great. It's good. It's really good.
You gotta love a good interview, don't you? Gotta love one. now you kept a whole bunch of stuff from the original Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Trilogy, I think it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are three.
That's three, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. What did you keep from Sin City?
I actually have my outfit from the movie.
Please tell me you never wear that.
That sort of like jaggedy Charlie Brown shirt.
That is, you in that film are one of the scariest things in existence.
I hear that a lot.
I bet you do.
That's really funny.
Do you ever wear that out?
No. No, but I was just going through my closet the other day where I keep things that I don't really wear, and I was moving through it and I was like, oh, fuck, I do have that. I haven't seen it in a while.
Halloween.
Yeah.
Easy money.
What else is in the cupboard? You got the zip top from the ice storm? Or
I wish. What else do I have?
Oh, that was an awe.
I've got... if anyone watches Wilfred, do you know that show Wilfred? Did we see that? I have Bear. If you would know what that is if you watch the show. And I have the Gatorade bong.
We all have one of those.
A hell of a night in is taking shape.
Yeah.
We got another question from the audience? Gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
If I'm not mistaken, you were in Skye's Treasure Island.
Yes.
Eddie Izzard. What was that experience like? And what's Eddie Izzard like? Because I love him with all my heart.
Eddie's great, man. Eddie's great. That man has more ambition on his pinky than I've seen in anybody. I mean, it's just ridiculous. He's running for mayor of London. He is going to different countries and learning their language and doing his comedy show in foreign languages. I mean, it's just, the guy doesn't stop. He's great. That was a lot of fun. I came in for a very short amount of time. I was there for 2 weeks, and it was in Puerto Rico. I'd never been to Puerto Rico before. And I played a really mad character, which was kind of great. It felt really freeing.
Were you a fan of the book?
Yeah. I hadn't read it since I was a child, but yeah, loved it growing up. So it was really, you know, it was pirates and muskets and shit. It was great. It was good fun.
That's the tagline.
Yeah. Treasure Island, pirates and muskets and shit.
Any more?
Hello.
Hello.
I'm just wondering, do you ever find yourself accidentally quoting yourself from films?
I love that. Accidentally. Like, oh, I've said that before. No. No. Oh man, that would be terrible. Weird, like accidental self-parody.
So like someone shows up at your house and you're like, you're late. Do you ever do that?
Yeah. Or yeah, or if someone needs a lift home, like I will take her. But I do not know the way. It's pretty funny. Maybe I'll use that.
We have a...
out of context, that could be bad.
Hi, I was just wondering. You always hear about people talking about how they've had really good experiences on set with other actors and that. But I was wondering, have you ever met an actor that you've really not liked and it's made the film worse to do?
Oh.
If you answer this question, you'll be the first person I've ever heard actually answer that question.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've worked when I was younger. I had some difficulty with certain people. I'm not going to name names, but I've had that happen. I honestly feel like I've heard more stories of that than I've actually had experiences. You sort of hear horror stories of actors behaving really poorly and being shitty and difficult to work with. And I honestly have had very few experiences like that and nothing that has truly ruined an experience. But I've definitely had like difficulty with certain people, and I've seen some bad behavior
for sure. But it's honestly, it's been pretty rare in my experience. I've been really lucky to work with a lot of good people, and I'm not just being diplomatic.
Now, this might go down as well as Franz Ferdinand, but I gather you're a fan of Chris Morris.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good yes. Great.
I love Chris Morris.
Have you had any cake recently?
No, apparently it's street value. It's really hard to get. Yeah. It's really hard to get these days.
It's huge around here. It's also huge around everywhere.
Yeah, cake is big. It's really the downfall of the English society. Fuck, Chris Morris. I got to meet Chris Morris. He brought Four Lions out to Austin, Texas for Fantastic Fest many years ago. And there was an after party, and Chris Morris was there. I was like, fuck, he's there. And I was so nervous to meet him. And he's awesome. He's so great. And I was still kind of intimidated talking to him because he's wildly intelligent, yeah, and quite serious and very dry. So I found him a little intimidating, but he was cool.
Yeah, he's so intelligent. He actually studied zoology at Bristol University, and now he's doing what he does now.
He studied zoology?
That is correct.
Wow.
I know. That's how you become a great comedic writer.
Oh. Apparently. Dude, Jam is so great.
When was the last time you watched that?
It's been a long time, but that honestly like pushed the bounds of what is fun. That show bummed me out more than it made me laugh.
Yeah.
it's so dark.
You know the phrase crying with laughter? It's that, but in a whole new meaning.
Yes. Yes.
So Elijah, is a Wookiee a bear?
Is a Wookiee a bear?
Yes.
A Wookiee is a Wookiee.
Right.
It's a very good answer to that question.
Okay,
actually.
Fair enough.
we should wrap up.
Are you guys excited about Star Wars? Apparently, they might have to push the movie 6 months because of the injury.
Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford actually broke his leg, not his ankle, and it might push the movie back 6 months from their original release date, which means it would come out around Memorial Day of 2016.
Whoa.
I don't think I can last that long.
This is the rumor.
You heard it here first?
More read it on the internet before I said it.
After you wrote it. Yeah, that's... You know what I hear, guys?
My spies in Pinewood.
My little birds. It has been nothing short than an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Oh, man, thanks.
Thank you for coming along.
Thank you for having me.
And yeah, I said it before, but we'll speak to you.
Is that Iron Brew?
Yes, it's for
you. We have a present
for
you.
That is the weirdest fucking shit. Honestly, I love that you clap. Yes, it is weird!
You are the only person.
Guys, this is such a strange thing. I've never... The last time I was in Glasgow, I was introduced to it. And just look at that! What the hell? Can anyone describe what this actually is?
I can describe what it tastes like.
What does it taste like?
Iron Brew? But with a question mark. Maybe four question marks at the end.
Right. Feel phenomenal. Not just feel good, feel phenomenal.
And you know that's a command. That's an order.
Oh my God. This is fantastic.
That went down
original
well.
And best.
Drink it now and stay with us for the rest of the podcast and see what happens.
As an experiment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Guys,
until next
you.
Time, this has been Elijah Wood.
Bye, guys.
Dallas King.
Feel phenomenal.
At Champ Celluloid. Brought us lots of little gifts. He brought us Iron Brews and I don't know what the fuck that is. And
local
caramel
cuisine.
Log, which is nice. That like a Scottish delicacy? I don't know. And then we have some shortbread fingers and a Scottish tablet. We don't do paracetamol up here. No, we do. We do this. Amazing. Thank you. Did anyone else bring anything for us?
We just great. Let him go without... organizing exactly when he's going to start at Empire. we haven't set out salary or terms or conditions or anything. It's like, a disaster. Yeah.
That was Elijah. Amazing. Time now in another tweak of tradition for the podcast format for our movie reviews. Now, the biggest release this week was not only foretold in the Book of Revelation, but was also hinted at by Nostradamus himself, who wrote, and this is an actual quote, "From the Isle of Emerald he rises, tough but fair, as a woman he disguises. Like what Les Dawson did, but with really obvious jokes about farts and willies.
Fuckless. Friends is on Comedy Central again. Watch that instead. It's the one where Gunther kisses Phoebe. That's
wow.
Not my words, but the words of Nostradamus. Wow. Really spooky, actually. He was, of course, talking about Mrs. Brown's Boys, the phenomenally shit comedy smash that has now taken to the big screen like a tapeworm to a rectum. in Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie. Now, this may come as a shock to you, but I've gone Irish again. It's going to be huge. It's going to be huge. My sister has booked tickets for 40 showings, but it hasn't screened for critics. And I don't think it ever will. I think...
I predict it'll get a de plus.
It's
deplorable.
It's debominable. So we don't have a review of that. But, you know, go along, see it this week, and then we'll judge by the number of people who run in the street. So instead, we're going to focus on Chef, which is an actual movie written, directed by, and starring Jon Favreau as a top chef who goes back to basics with a food truck when he loses his job. So, Philbert.
Aye.
What did you think of this?
Well, liked it. It's feel good in every sense, really. It's a movie that sees Jon Favreau kind of getting back to sort of slightly smaller. I mean, it's an independent film. And he stars as a chef, Carl Casper, who's kind of, he's trying to push the boundaries of the food he serves in his restaurant, Marco Pierre White, kind of Gordon Ramsay style. Dustin Hoffman plays the restaurant proprietor who says, no, keep serving the same stuff we've been making that's popular with the clients. And everything gets thrown in flux when a snarky restaurant blogger turns up and just dismantles him on the internet. He decides to fire back, I think, what's drunkenly on Twitter. And that's a mistake, as we all know. And it all ends basically with him getting back to basics, getting a food truck and hitting the road with his semi-estranged son and serving good old-fashioned, basically cheese sandwiches, I think.
But essentially, that's what it is.
It is. This film is basically a film about cheese sandwiches, but they are amazing cheese sandwiches. And it's a film that is just full of food. There aren't that many movies that celebrate food, which is weird because most of us have to eat. And this one is kind of a definite, it's a lot of fun. We gave it 3 stars. I was probably a little more down on it than you guys were. I felt it was a little overlong, probably, and just a tiny bit sort of self-indulgent at points. The pace slightly sagged out of it for me. But yeah, a lot of fun.
I would issue one word of warning. I am very positive Phil is correct on this, but don't go in on an empty stomach. I did. And it was torture. The food in this film just looks incredible. It's, you know, you will be salivating. There is a moment halfway through the film. Now, this is not, I'm not kidding about this. There's a moment halfway through where somebody takes out a big lump of brisket that's been slow, sort of roasted over low fire overnight. And it's all kind of caramelized on the outside. And then he cuts into it. And I'm not kidding, half the audience just went, oh. So really, don't go in on an empty stomach. Preferably have some brisket before you go.
It's food porn. Looks
incredible. Yes.
Or and
it's
foreign,
and the film itself does have that feeling of slightly being comfort food. It's quite an old-fashioned sort of a story in many ways. It's just a guy reconnecting with his family, reconnecting with his, I guess, art. And it's a sort of a good-hearted, you know, simply told tale that's just really well done for my money.
It's really interesting how the next film from the director of Cowboys and Aliens is a smaller film about a man trying to rediscover himself as an artist. You know, Dustin Hoffman is his boss, and you can read that as studio interference. Basically, he's telling him, no, make the stuff that the people want to see. And the artist is going, no, I want to make swingers again. Not swingers, I mean a sandwich. And there's so much a metaphor, I think, for where Jon Favreau is in his career right now. And what this film reminds us is that he is the guy who wrote Swingers, and he is the guy who wrote Made and directed Made, which is a film I really, really like. And he's still got that sort of independent spirit in him. This is a glossier independent film than perhaps we're used to, although it was still quite low budget. But it's just such a joyous vibe to this movie for me. It's such a nice group of characters to hang out with, a nice selection of food to salivate over. But, you know, we've all sat there with our MasterChef box sets, haven't we? I mean, I have, in my pants. And and this is going to be a nice addition, I think, to that. You know, this is going to be a great movie. I'd love to hear the Greg Wallace commentary on this film.
This is well-seasoned and full of flavour.
What you've done, a wonderful thing. Don't be fooled by the advert. Scarlett Johansson is in this movie. Robert Downey Jr. is in this film. But there's a TV spot. There's a TV spot I saw that literally went, Robert Downey Jr. is amazing, as if he was a star of the film. He's in one scene.
Literally in one scene, and he basically plays, you may be shocked to guess, Robert Downey Jr. But he's really, really funny.
Very good at that.
He's very, very good. I just really like this film, and I'm just staring at this caramel log as I talk about a film that celebrates food, and what the hell is this? Is this a real thing?
It's caramel grown inside a log.
Okay, done. I'll have one now. You guys talk about the film. I'll eat this.
I don't like that kind of racism. Let's kind of keep that down. You talk about being food porn. There is one scene where the greatly talented Scarlett Johansson is just staring at Jon Favreau as he cooks pasta. And essentially all he does is, you know, boils the pasta, trick one. Trick two, add ingredients, serve. But the way it's done, you almost expect some kind of like deep bass to start coming through the speakers. Bow, bow, bow. And she's just sitting there going...
It's quite a sexy scene.
Sexy scene.
Do you remember in, I think it's The Ipcress File, where Michael Caine takes a girl back to his flat and he said to her, I'm going to cook you the best meal you've ever eaten. And he basically makes a ragu spaghetti. And you're like, really? In the 60s, I think that would have counted.
But. Probably would have, yeah. There wasn't much great food around that time. What did it for me was the cheese toastie that he makes for his son. And he has the most amazing stove, which if you heard last week's podcast, Jon Favreau talked about, he's now bought that stove. And he's got this huge range, and it's got like a hot plate on top, just perfect for making cheese toasties, and it just looks delectable.
I agree. That bit was ridiculous. I really, really, really wanted that sandwich. I am really behind this film. I really enjoyed it. It's old-fashioned. It's a bit hokey. It does go on a bit too long. It gave me a great feeling. I really enjoyed it. I can't wait to watch it with my mum. It's that kind of homely family film. I'm really behind this. If you're curious about it at all, I'd say go and watch it.
Definitely.
But, you know, 3 stars is a recommendation.
I agree with that, absolutely. That's actually quite nice, the caramel log. It's quite nice. It's not Favreau-sized, but it's quite nice. Yeah, we say family film, it's quite sweary.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting, I
think. Yeah, but Jenny, you know, she loves swearing, so it's fine.
Loves the old swearing, your mum.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So 3 stars for Chef, that is a recommendation. What is next? Oh, yes.
Goodbye.
Yeah, it's Colton July. Because last time we did a live podcast, it was back in February. The first one was for 100th edition. We reviewed a Jim Mickle film, and then he's just to show that, you know, Miller and Lord aren't the only ones who can make 2 films every week. He has come back again with Colton July, which is played here at the Edinburgh Film Festival. It's a late 80s set thriller starring Michael C. Hall, Don Johnson, and Sam Shepard. It's about a small town guy who kills an intruder into his house. And that sparks off a whole series of twists and turns, which goes into some very, very dark areas. Helena.
Yes. This is a film that I'm not going to say too much about the plot, because it's one of those ones where you genuinely don't... The less you know going in, the better. If you've seen the trailer, I think it does a really good job of both setting up the film and actually giving very little away, really. So it starts off with Michael C. Hall with a mullet for the ages, because this is kind of set in the 80s rather than the present day. He hears an intruder in the house. He wakes up. This is literally pretty much opening scene stuff. Goes to try and confront the guy. His gun goes off pretty much by accident, and he kills him. And this is not a tough guy. This is not a, you know, some kind of Western archetype. He is horrified by what he's done. He's very shaken up by it. He's kind of talked through it by his local police, who are like, don't worry, you know, it's entirely understandable. This guy was in your house in the middle of the night, and he's a bad guy. You're fine. And all seems well until the guy's father shows up, who's played by Sam Shepard, and starts essentially stalking the family. So it gets into some really creepy territory. The music is very, very 80s, very John Carpenter kind of stuff. Really, really atmospheric. And you can practically feel the sort of the sweat dripping down the back of your neck, both from fear and from the humidity, because it's just all sort of sweaty, southern kind of Texas setting. I'm not going to say too much more about what Sam Shepard does. Don Johnson turns up a little bit later on. Is it Nick D'Amici, who is Jim Mickles, the director's writing partner, also plays a key role as one of the policemen. And it develops in very unexpected ways. And I think it's one of those films that can change tone in a way that doesn't take you out of the film, which is a rare and a beautiful thing when a film can do that. And I think this one did that exceptionally well. But again, I'm not saying how or why or when or what it changes, but there are some changes coming. I'm not going to call them twists either, but it's a really, really clever film.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think this is a fantastic film. I think Jim Mickle is a really interesting filmmaker to keep an eye on. I really like Stakeland. I think I fell in love with We Are What We Are, which tells you something about me because I'm quite sick. And that's another film that might make you want to eat. I'm just
kind of
throw it out there. Yeah, I'd trip a bill, Chef, We Are What We Are, and The Green Inferno. That would be an interesting little concoction to make. This film's fantastic. It turns in a dime. The performances are great. Michael C. Hall's fantastic. Don Johnson shows up about halfway through and really injects it with a sense of energy and a sense of fun. He's a private detective. He's very, very eccentric. There's a lovely interplay between the three leads, which is great. And it just changes every 5 minutes. You think you know what you've got to handle in the movie. It's a stalker movie. It's a horror film. It's a corrupt cop movie. It goes into areas you might not expect. And it also features really interesting supporting turns as well. Mm-hmm. Wyatt Russell, who is Kurt Russell's and Goldie Hawn, Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn's son, who was so good in 22 Jump Street, if anyone saw that, is in this as well and can play in the complete opposite of his 22 Jump Street character. I won't give anything away beyond that, but yeah, he's quite scary in this film. And I think Mikkel's a real deal. I really do. I thought this film was fantastic.
He'll probably be signed up for another Star Wars in a minute. Like, he's a young and very talented kind of indie director at the moment, so it stands to reason. Star Wars.
Star Wars, yeah.
Or the next Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
One of those.
Set in Alabama.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I said this before in the podcast a couple of weeks ago, but you know, honestly, make The Thing 2, but with Wyatt Russell as RJ McCready, and you could just pick it up where it left off. Just dye his hair, and you are good to go, I think. And we gave Colton July 4 stars. 4 English stars, which translate up here as Scottish stars, of course. They're exactly the same. So, yeah, it's really, really good. So do check that one out. Also out this week is the 4-star Spanish drama, The Golden Dream, which is very, very good. There's also Walking in Sunshine, to which we gave 2 stars. It's perhaps, I guess, most notable for, I guess, marking the debut of Gemma Arterton's sister, Hannah Arterton.
Great talent.
Great talent. Great, great talent. There's also A Haunted House 2, which is the latest from Marlon Wayans' Arsenal of Terror. I don't think we've reviewed that yet. Have we actually given it a star rating? Have we had a critic brave enough to
I'm not sure there was a screening of that for critics.
There wasn't. So if anyone fancies coming around the weekend and watching that and Mrs. Brown Boys, the movie, with us, then please, do God, report yourself to the authorities because you need to turn yourself in. And last but not least, before we move on to the questions section where you ask us stuff, Ali would like to wax lyrical about one film in particular because it touched him in a deep and pleasant place. Amazing. What is that film, Ali?
Well, I mentioned how I'm a bit of a hipster twatic kind of guy. The National. None more indie band for indie folk who like thinking about how sad things can be and deep voices and, you know, repetitive riffs and, you know, words don't really make any sense. They are a band, and the lead singer of the band, I'm going to get the pronunciation right for once in my life, he's called Matt Berninger, the lead singer, and his brother's called Tom. Now, Tom is a schlub, whereas Matt is a cerebral, clever, worthy man. And he invites his brother along on this tour around the world to see what his life is like and give him something to do. The movie's called Mistaken for Strangers. It's ostensibly a music doc, but actually ends up not being a music doc at all, because what Tom wants to do is do a music doc about the National. What it ends up being is him having a series of squabbles and fights with not only his brother, but with the rest of the, you know, roadies who are doing this thing. And it's more about him being a bit of an asshole and his brother telling him he's an asshole and him not realizing that he's an asshole, and then them having these butting of heads, but then his brother still loves him. I can't do it justice. One of those films that you just need to see. You don't need to be a fan of the National. Obviously, that would help because there is a little bit of the old-fashioned 5 to 10 minutes of them just playing. But it's a very meta, very clever, very self-aware, clever comedy that at times reaches the peaks of Spinal Tap, but not through any intention. It's just somebody being a bit of a melon, and you just watch him, just he makes the most ridiculous decisions and thinks, well, are microphones necessary? I mean, for a band? Oh, they are. Oh, great. Okay. Yeah, I meant to get them. Good. It turns into something just crazy. So just watch it. It may end up being something you see on Netflix. It may be something you see on iTunes. But do remember the name, Mistaken for Strangers. And Phil, I know you're a big fan.
I'm a big fan of the National.
Yeah.
And you. And I wondered, I gathered that Werner Herzog makes an appearance in this movie. Is that true?
Yes, as does Emily Blunt and John Krasinski. The bastard. Great talent, great talent. They are there at this National gig that obviously the National are performing at. And there are a whole host of very famous folk who are on the guest list. And guess who doesn't give the guest list to the front of house? his brother. And so suddenly it's just Matt, who is normally cool as a cucumber, just loses his shit because Werner Herzog can't get him the fucking gig. Anyway, you do see him look inordinately pissed off, even more so when Tom is there with a camera going, it's Werner Herzog! So yeah, there you go. Mistake of Strangers, 4 stars.
4 stars.
Empire. My review, so take it all with a pinch of salt.
Oh, fantastic. Sounds great. So that's the reviews nicely out of the way. On now to our second guest. When we knew we were coming to Edinburgh, I was desperate to have a local hero on the podcast. They don't come much more local or heroic, in fact, than this man. He's the honorary patron of the Lyceum, the theatre just across the road from here, where he started his career. He's one of the finest actors around. He's an Empire icon and has a shiny Perspect trophy that cost us £5 to prove it. He's the original Hannibal Lecter, the original William Stryker, and along a brilliant screen career, he's shone in everything from Super Troopers to the Bourne films to Zodiac, 25th Hour, and Adaptation, to name but five. He'll soon be seen as Sir Matt Busby in Believe, and he's in town to celebrate the 19th anniversary, or the 20th anniversary, if you want to get finickety about it, of the start of shooting.
Sure.
On Braveheart, Mel Gibson's Braveheart. Please welcome the original and best, Brian Cox! Brian, hello, sir.
Hello. How
welcome.
Are you?
How are you?
Fine. Frenetic. Just got here, but good.
You're here in town to promote...
For Braveheart. Braveheart, yeah. It's the 20th anniversary, I think, when we started it. We filmed it... Yeah, we started July, I think. It was roughly then we started.
Okay.
Yeah.
And have you met up with the cast since?
No, not yet, because I literally, I came down, I was fishing up in Aberfeldy, so I just come down.
Did you catch anything?
I did. We caught, well, actually, we were fishing in a little place near Dundee called Forbes of Kilkenny, and we caught 15 fish.
Very good.
We sent 12 of them back, and we've kept 3.
Is that a usual haul for you? Do you
no,
more,
no, no, I've never caught anything before in my life.
Really?
No, it was the first time I'd fly fished, and I caught one.
That's not bad. Then,
but my son prefers, my son's with me, so he prefers bait. He didn't like fly fishing. He says it's boring. But anyway, no, I like fly fishing.
But obviously, does Braveheart, in a way, does it hold a place in your heart?
Yeah, it does. It was an extraordinary event, actually, the whole thing. I happened to be also in the other movie, Rob Roy, which was made at the same time. In fact, I didn't change hotel room. I literally went from, I was staying in the Spean Bridge Hotel, and I went from one, and I kept the same hotel room. It was really bizarre. It was really weird.
So basically, between the two of those, you seem to have like summed up Scottish history on film, really.
Yeah. The director, Rob Roy, he was very funny. He was called Michael Caton Jones. He comes from Broxbourne. We'll let that pass. He tried to persuade me, because I'm the only actor in both the movies. I'm the only Scottish actor that's in both of the movies. I don't know about English actors, but I'm a Scottish actor. So he said, you know, Brian, I think it would be better if you didn't do Braveheart. And I said, why? And he said, well, you know, all these kilts. I said, yeah, but there's something like 400 years of history between them. You know, they're quite different. I mean, he should have known that, but then he's from Broxbourne, so... But I said, fine, I won't do it. That's great. I'm very happy. So if you kindly give me, and I wrote it down, with the money I was getting, I said, and then I won't do it. And he said, oh, well, hold on a minute. So I ended up doing both, and it was great.
Yeah. Excellent. How did Mel Gibson persuade you, apart from writing down a figure?
Well, he didn't do that. I was up for both movies, and I chose to do Rob Roy because I really liked the script of Rob Roy. I mean, Braveheart's iconic, but Rob Roy is written by a guy called Alan Sharp, who's sadly no longer with us, and he wrote this fantastic script, and I was offered this really horrible part. I mean, not horrible, it was a great part, but it was a horrible character. And I thought, it's interesting. And then Mel wanted me to play sort of one of the characters, but it wasn't as attractive a deal. So I accepted the Rob Roy, and then he came after me, and he said, well, I want you to be in the movie. What are you going to play? I said, well, it sort of clashes. He said, no. I said, well, the only part that's really interesting, but he was described as cadaverous, and I am not exactly cadaverous, was Uncle Argyle. I said, that's the part that's really interesting. And he said, that's it. That's what you're going to do, play Uncle Argyle. And originally I was to, there was a scene where I was supposed to marry Mirren and William, but actually I didn't do that, somebody else did it. Yeah. So I was only going to be on the, I was only available to do it, but it was great. And I love Mel, I mean, he was just, he's just such energy, he has such phenomenal energy, and that was a great thing. And of course, he'd had a tough time up at Seven Sisters where they filmed all the Scottish bit. I was in the Scottish bit, I wasn't in the Irish bit. And it became quite difficult for him because the weather swept the set away at one point. And I remember going up, and I finished the last day in Scotland. And quite frankly, he was knackered. I mean, he was absolutely knackered. And I thought, this man's got to go on for 3 months in Ireland, also playing the part. And I thought, ooh. And apparently what happened, Errol Lyman, the assistant, told me this wonderful story that Mel was exhausted. In fact, David Twomlin, who I had to do a little scene, he was the assistant director, first assistant. He kind of was helping Mel, and Mel was, I could see him, he was sitting in the corner, and we were in kind of this wee bothy that we were, that was Uncle Argyle, well, it's William's house we were in, it's after he dies, and we're having this meal together, the boy and myself. And Mel was really, you know, clearly knackered. And I thought, how the hell is he going to manage the next 3 months? And apparently what happened, that when he got to Ireland, it was, that famous scene, you know, the famous freedom scene, was the first thing he shot. And he had to climb this hill, and all the extras and all the Irish army were down in this valley. And as he was climbing up the hill, he was still knackered. And the second assistant, it was a guy called Errol Lyman, he was very concerned about whether Melt's going to make it.
Yeah.
And he got to the top of the hill, and he took one look at all the extras and the whole of all, you know, thousands of Scots down there in the, and ready to do battle, you know. Yeah. And he went, well, this is it. And he kind of rose up, jumped on the horse, and he never looked back.
Amazing.
And apparently he said he's just got this phenomenal burst of energy that never left him for the next 3 months.
Wow, that's right.
But it's amazing what, you know, what Dr. Cinema and Dr. Theatre would do. You know.
Yeah, I can imagine. Is that something you felt as well, maybe in the middle of a long run in the theatre?
Yeah, yeah, you get that way, you know, you get that. There's a famous story of Yul Brynner, which I love. It's a story when he was dying, and he was doing, he was playing another revival of The King and I, and he would walk to the stage very, very slowly, you know, and he'd hear, da, da, dum, and he'd stop. He'd start lifting one foot, then the other foot, then the other foot. And eventually he'd break into this dance.
Yeah.
And he'd bounce on stage, do the dance, come off, and completely collapse.
Oh,
and went
God.
Back. And it is amazing what happens, you know. It's a real, you know, it's a real inoculation.
Mm. What about Mel becoming Scottish for the role? I mean, I was watching the new documentary that they've made for this new Blu-ray release, and the chief of Clan Wallace, who consulted on the film with him, said that he sort of spent a lot of time with them and learned to mimic their walk, and he said he walked like a Scottish man who's coming to kill you, and we all recognised it.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a great line. So yeah. Is that something you recognise as well?
Yeah, well, Mel has that kind of, you know, he's quite demonic. You know, there's a kind of tremendous demonic. See, but I actually think he's one of the nicest men. I mean, I adore him, and I know he's had a lot of bad press over the years, but I think he's very misunderstood as well, too, because he's very, you know, he's very immediate and in your face. But the irony, too, of course, about him, I mean, I always thought it was weird that actually physically he's more like Rob Roy than right William Wallace, because Rob Roy was a wiry wee guy with rickets and reddish hair, and William Wallace was 6'6". Mel ain't 6'6". Liam Neeson, on the other hand, you know, who played Rob Roy.
Yeah.
So physically, they were actually the wrong way around. And I believe that Mel actually had originally been approached to play Rob Roy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it passed on it. Oh. So it was interesting because he has that kind of, and he could deal very well with those who were alcoholically inclined. no names, no pack drill,
no,
but
no,
he was
not.
Brilliant at dealing with them. He was an absolute master because he had been considerably alcoholically inclined in his day.
Yeah.
So he knew about the headbangers, you know. And there was one character who shall be nameless who was particularly headbangerish. And Mel apparently dealt with him quite brilliantly.
You are just about, you've got a movie coming out in a couple of weeks called Believe, in which you play another Scottish icon, Sir Matt Busby.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Because it was Matt Busby
fantastic.
Way after his Manchester United manager.
Yeah, this is a story. I met Sandy Busby just recently, who he said it was partly true, but not many, many people knew about it. In fact, it was a bit of a secret in the family that he at one time managed, after he retired, he managed this little team of boys. And it comes through a long, extraordinary story, but there's a character played by Phil Jackson, who is a sort of very close friend of Matt Busby's, this character. And he told this story to, actually it was Italians, these two Italian guys, who then told the story to somebody else. And then this script was written called Believe, which is about, it was originally called Theatre of Dreams, but now it's called Believe. Mm. And it was about him really in retirement. He was very haunted by the Munich air disaster, particularly because he felt it was very much his fault. Partly to do with the fact that the Football League in those days were very anti-Europe, and he was one of the first big pro-European football who believed in European football and believed that the future of football was connected with European football. So he made this promise that he would go to Munich and he would get back for the Saturday fixture where Manchester was supposed to be playing some team. And as a result, they tried to take off three times, and on the third time they didn't make it. And Sandy told this really tragic story about how Matt was all wired up, and Duncan Edwards had not died. He was still seriously ill. They didn't think his injuries were as bad as they were, and it turned out it was a lot worse. Mm. So he subsequently died. But Matt asked his wife, he mentioned he went through the names of the players and asked her to nod or shake her head when ones that were lost. And he was quite devastated by this, you know, when she shook her head, he'd mentioned names. And he really, at that point, he was on the point of giving up. He said, "That's it, I'm not doing it anymore." And he said, and his wife, who was an amazing woman, said, "You know, no, you owe it to the memory of these boys to go on." So this picks up like 30 years later when he's retired. And he retired from Man U. And he still has, the ghosts of the boys are still there. So they're in the film. Their ghosts are still there. It's a bit like Field of Dreams. They're still there, those boys. And he meets these kids, and it's about belief. It's about following your dreams and following your bliss. I think it's a lovely film. It's a real family film.
You're playing as well someone that, you know, he was around, I guess, as you were growing up. And as
I remember, I used to go and get the Beano on a Thursday at my newsagents in Arbroath Road in Dundee, and I always used to collect the Beano and the Film Fun, which were my two comics. The Dandy was the Tuesday, the Beano and the Film Fun was on the Thursday. And I remember going down to get the Beano, and the Evening Telly, which was the Dundee evening paper, had just come in, and Stop Press was the plane that didn't take off, you know, the plane that crashed. So I remember then being quite traumatized. But not traumatized, but, you know, I mean, quite shaken by it, even as a kid. And I was, I was 11 or 10 at the time. I think it was 11. And I remember it vividly, and I remember following the progression, because, you know, in those days it was to do with the papers. You didn't get much in the news and the television, but it was, and the telly had a thing every night about what was going on.
Yeah.
And it was following the eventual demise of Duncan Edwards, which was, because he was this major player at the time. So it was quite potent for me.
And you've played a lot of bad guys in your time, but you've also played a lot of good guys as well. And one of the roles that really resonates for me is 25th Hour.
Great
role. You have that amazing monologue at the end of the film.
Written by David Benioff, who writes and produces
Game of Thrones.
He really interesting, David. It's a fantastic book. And again, great story. We recorded that speech. And then Spike Lee, who'd never been to Austin, he'd never been to Texas before, he fell in love with Texas, and he also fell in love with the speech. And so it became a much bigger part of the movie than he originally intended. So I had to redo the speech again, that famous story when they go over the bridge. But it's a fantastic movie, and he is truly, truly great filmmaker. He's probably one of the finest filmmakers I've ever worked with, I think.
And was that speech basically, was that just you in a room?
It was me in a room with his editor, whose name escapes me now. Mm-hmm. We did it first of all, and then I was doing X-Men. I was in Vancouver doing X-Men. They flew into X-Men, and then I redid the whole speech.
Amazing. We've got time for a couple of questions from you guys for Brian now. If you have anything you want to ask him, then put your hands up, and we have Rovi microphones knocking around. And if you're all very, very shy.
Don't be shy. Go on.
You won't bite, will you? In that case, we'll progress on. Thank you. And suddenly everyone brings their hands up. We knew it.
One of my favourite films that you've did was, I think, was it The Escapist?
Oh, yeah.
I just wondered what your experiences were on that, and obviously the director you followed into with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes as well.
Yeah.
And was there any sort of consistency to his
A good story there, too. Peter Chernin, who produced Planet of the Apes, rang me about, because I was also one of the producers on The Escapist. And The Escapist was... It's a really interesting movie. This young man, Rupert Wyatt, who I'd worked with, I did a short film which he won a BAFTA prize for, where everybody had the flu, including the first assistant. No, the first assistant left because somebody had an accident. But everybody was sick, and we did this film, and it was an amazing film. It was set in Afghanistan, but he shot in Hackney, and we shot it just before the, as you do. And it was just before, it's actually now where the Olympic Village is, but it was before it was kind of a wasteland then. And he did really well with it. And then he came to me one day and he said, I want to make a bigger version of this. And I like being a supporting actor, don't get me wrong, but occasionally I like to play center forward as well as left back, you know. So I said, you know, I get asked to help a lot of people with their careers, and I'm very happy to do that. But occasionally, I'd like to do something a bit more interesting, you know. So he said, oh, okay. And then he went away, and he came back, and he wrote The Escapist, and he wrote it for me. And I loved the script. I said, now I know that, you know, everybody's going to go after the script and ask you to change it. And I don't want you to change a word of it. So I'm going to keep the original script, and you're going to go out there and sell it and do all your notes and do all your coverage that everybody asks you to do, but then we're going to go back. I mean, there was a to the original script, you know, it was a tactic, you know, and the best tactic, because, you know, I don't believe in committee films, you know, they're boring beyond extreme, you know. I love the idea of somebody's vision, and it was a brilliant vision. So he did it, and it was an incredible film to work on. It was a great cast. The footnote, every single member of the cast was a Gemini for some unknown reason, which was bizarre. And when he did the film, there was a morning that, as I was wearing my acting hat, my producer hat, where the the scene was, they dig a tunnel. And I thought, he's given himself an hour to dig a tunnel. I thought, it can't be done. And I thought this was the height of hubris on his part, that he was going to do an hour scene digging a tunnel in an hour. But he did, because he had worked it out so carefully and brilliantly, and the sequence is there in the film. And we did do it, and we did it in an hour. And when Peter Chernin rang me up, and he said, this guy, you know, this Rupert Wyatt, I love this film that you did for him. I said, he's a great director. I said, and also he's going to save you a lot of money. And I said, because he's very quick, you know. And it's the interesting thing about young directors, because sometimes the young directors are ambitious, but they forget about the pounds, shillings, and pence. They forget about the kind of housekeeping of a film. But you know, he so desperately wanted to make the film that he understood totally about the housekeeping, totally about how what to spend and not what to spend. It's like doing poor theatre. It's like doing lunchtime theatre, that you get a director who really knows, understands what he's got to work, or she understands, or a female as well. So it was a tremendous experience, and as a result of that, he got the job, Planet of the Apes, and then he had to deal with the heavy dudes, you know, coming in and giving him note after note after note after note. But he kept his head and survived it. But it was tough.
We got time for one last question. This gentleman over here, have you got the microphone?
I was just wanting to know, how did Michael Mann come to pick you to be the original Hannibal Lecter and Manhunter?
There was a lot of people up for that role, including John Lithgow, Brian Dennehy, and I was doing a play on called Rat in the Skull, which was a play about Northern Ireland. I was playing at the Public Theatre in New York. We'd done it in London, it had been a big success, and we moved there. And this wonderful, very eccentric woman called Bonnie Timmerman came to see it. And the next thing I knew, I was invited to go along and audition for it. And this guy that I was working with, an actor called Phil Jackson, Philip, I said, would you come and read the scene with me? Because I don't want to read it with some kind of faceless secretary who can barely get two words out. So he said, yeah, sure, I'll come. In fact, I still owe him for that after all these years. And so I came, and Bonnie Timmerman was very funny, and she said, would you mind if I didn't see you? I said, I beg your pardon? She said, I don't want to see you. I said, but I'm doing an audition on tape. What do you mean? She said, I don't want to see, where I was in the theater, I was listening to you. I couldn't see you for the first 20 minutes of where I was sitting, but I could hear your voice. And it was your voice that really got me. And it was the voice that I'm interested. I said, okay. So I turned my back to her and turned my back to the camera and played the whole thing with my back. So that all you saw was my ear. And eventually, at one point, I did turn around, which is ironically how I start off the scene. You know, unlike Tony Hopkins, who's standing right in the middle of the set. So very visually, you didn't see me because all you heard was my voice. It was as a result of that that she was my champion. So she actually got me the job. And it was great. It was one of those amazing experiences. But the film, it was interesting because the film was produced by Dino De Laurentiis, and he owned he did subsequently all those films, but he never liked Manhunter, not because he didn't like the film, because it represented the time when he went bust. He became bankrupt. He made a film called, this is a film set in Chinatown with Mickey Rourke, and he filmed down in Wilmington.
Year of the Dragon.
Year of the Dragon. Yeah, yeah. That's right, because we were, you know, it's called Red Dragon, and the Year of the Dragon. He said, "Well, I can't call it Red Dragon because I've just made the Year of the Dragon, so they changed it to Manhunter." And so we made the film, and the film lay in escrow for a long time. We opened it in L.A., and it had tremendous notices, some of the best notices I've ever been associated with. But then we didn't have the screens; we couldn't put it out there because Dino De Laurentiis didn't have the money. He was broke. And the film was in escrow because it was part of a legal thing. So it floundered, you know, it did well, it floundered. And then Jeremy Thomas, like 4 years later, yeah, sort of 3 years later, rediscovered the film and put it out in England and then subsequently in Europe. And then it became a big success. And then they did the famous Silence of the Lambs, which I wasn't in, and there are reasons for that, which too long to go on. But the interesting thing is that they then decided NBC to buy Red Dragon or Manhunter, and it was the highest rated TV film of all times because they put it out after, and it's something like, I don't know, it's something like 30 million saw it in one night. So it's quite a fascinating story about the whole story of Red Dragon. I mean, it's a kind of, you know, it's almost encyclopedic in its story.
It is amazing. Brian, we're going to let you go, but I just want to ask one very last, very, very quick thing. Last time I saw you was at the Empire, the Jemison Empire Awards back in March.
That's right.
When for the first time ever, you and the other Brian Cox met.
I know.
What was that experience like?
Well, what was it like? It was bizarre because, I am a professor, believe it or not. I have several doctorates, though I don't go around saying I'm Professor Brian Cox. as you know, for some unknown reason, you made him give an award, which was for something which I thought was highly inappropriate. I thought, why are they asking this guy to give the award? So they called for Professor Brian Cox to come to the stage to present the award. So I got up. My son was there, and he said, I dare you. I said, I'm going to do it. He said, I dare. I said, no, I'm going to do it. So I got up. So we both, the Brian Coxes, came on the stage at the same time. And it was all done in good humor. You know, it's tiresome, but there you go. I mean, you learn a lot of lessons about what's in a name, you know, a lot more than you think. Let me.
On that note, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. Professor Brian Cox, everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
At the end there, Brian Cox said to me, you instigated that meeting, which is kind of true.
In slightly accusatory terms.
Yeah, no, because I was interviewing the other Brian Cox. I was interviewing Brian Cox. And the other one was hovering just out of shot waiting for his turn. And I suddenly realized, holy shit, this is history. So it's actually on the internet. I think you can go and see it on the Empire's YouTube page. That moment when history was made. And Time Cop lied to us because they actually shook hands and the world didn't implode, which is great. Yeah, Braveheart is out now on Blu-ray, DVD, and it's available digitally as well. Absolute legend. And yes, as we pointed out earlier on, we've had Cox, Wood and Johnson on the podcast as well. If only we'd had Alan Cumming. Okay, now it's time to finish off with your questions for us. Think of this as a live Reddit AMA, but one where we actually can tell what's going on. I don't understand those things at all. So let's get your hands in the air if you have any questions at all for us. There's a gentleman right at the very, very back by the pillar. First question, no pressure.
Seeing as we are in Scotland, I'm just going to ask you all, what is your favourite Scottish set film?
Favourite Scottish film?
Local Hero. Got in there.
Damn
first.
It!
Yes!
Gregory's Girl. Second. Hooray, there we go. I can't look beyond Trainspotting, really. I think that film's amazing. And Shallow Grave, you mean, you know, which I think is a Scottish film, even though Danny Boyle is not Scottish himself. I think that film, those two films are a fantastic double bill for me.
I remember seeing Shallow Grave when it came out in the cameo. It's a disloyal thing to say when I'm in the film house, isn't it? Does anyone know where the opening shot of that film was set? Is that in Edinburgh or Glasgow when they're driving?
Edinburgh.
Is it Edinburgh? Because I think I lived on one of those roads as well. So I have a special place in my heart for Shallow Grave.
Obviously,
you can see me.
I lived on a road featured in Ronin, the Paris set film. Yeah, just thought I'd share that.
Where? Why not? Where?
In Paris.
Oh, okay.
That's going nowhere.
No, I'm just saying, Sean Bean threw up on my street. I mean, that's a big deal. Sean Bean throws up on the street in a film. That's something you want to remember.
Sean Bean's thrown up on everyone's street at some point.
I used to live in a road where Simon Pegg was recently shooting Absolutely Anything, which is the movie where he's teaming up with the Monty Python man, Terry Jones. And I've tried to explain this film before, but essentially it's a little bit like Bruce Almighty, except with Simon Pegg, and there's a talking dog played by Robin Williams. Anyway, I was walking to my local Budgeons, and there was a series of men wearing balaclavas in the back of a pickup truck pretending to shoot at me. And I just thought, this trip is going horribly wrong. Yeah, so that's my tidbit for movies that have appeared on my road.
Amazing.
Sorry,
which wasn't the question, I think. No. I think you asked something else.
My favourite Scottish film, I've already alluded to it, but my question to you guys is, who wants to live forever?
Oh, what a film. It takes a really special film to cast Sir Sean Connery as, I think he's meant to be an Egyptian. He's actually not even meant to be Spanish. He's meant to be an Egyptian originally.
That's correct, yes.
Who spent a lot of time in Japan, obviously, to get his sword.
Yes.
And then became a Spanish nobleman.
That's correct.
While casting a Frenchman as a Highlander. Oh,
I know.
It's magic.
Madness. I've never had a film shoot in my street before. Ever. I just wanted to throw that out there.
Hollywood, if you're listening.
I just feel quite left out. However, I was on the set of X-Men Days of Future Past, which was quite good. Sorry, we trampled all of your questions, but anyone else? Yes, you, sir, and we'll not answer your question as well.
This is the guy that said he brought some love for us.
Oh.
Did you?
Bag. Yeah, I'll pass it on at the end.
Is it a caramel log?
There's no caramel log, I'm afraid.
Okay.
I'm not Scottish, as you can hear, I'm afraid. So no caramel logs.
But, no judgment here.
So with like all this talk about like Ryan Johnson and Colin Trevorrow, Josh Trank, all that kind of thing, would you not rather they, like realistically, they were working on their own original projects instead of kind of being swallowed up? Because if you think about the films that are actually the most interesting this year, like from what you guys have got most excited about on the podcast, stuff like Calvary, Grand Budapest Hotel, 12 Years a Slave, that kind of thing. Not that any of them are going to make 12 Years a Slave, but I mean, would you not prefer them to be working on their own projects and just get someone a bit more homogenous to be making?
Now I want to see Wes Anderson's Star Wars.
That would be amazing.
That would be astonishing.
I just really want someone to use your word homogenous to just knock episode 8 in the park.
I'd love to see Wes Anderson a long time ago in a perfectly symmetrical galaxy far, far away.
Just make the opening credits with scrolls.
That would be awesome. Yeah, yes, good idea.
I kind of agree with you and kind of don't. I agree with you in the sense that whatever it was that Rian Johnson was talking about, which probably isn't Star Wars, is probably fascinating on the basis of his films to date. So I do want him to make that. I think, though, and I also think that, you know, the length of time these films take to make, you're talking 2.5 years director time, at least, generally speaking. That's a lot of time to be out of the indie game. That said, you do one of these and it can set you up for the next 10 years. You do one of these and you can get your $10 million project greenlit for the next, you know, however many of them you can make. And you probably get a built-in audience that hopefully follows you to those films and means that they will be profitable. So I think there's an element of what Guillermo del Toro has always done, which is, you know, one for them, one for me. I think there's an element of, if you do Hellboy, then you get the green light for Pan's Labyrinth. And if that is the case, then they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, I think I've said this before in the podcast as well, though. These guys grew up loving Star Wars and Jurassic Park and Rian Johnson's a Star Wars nut, and Colin Trevorrow, you know, grew up loving Jurassic Park as well. So I think they're really, really nice fits for it. And I think these guys, I've said this before in the podcast, bring a really nice indie sensibility as well as a commercial sensibility as well. So I don't think Phelan will see it necessarily. They're slumming it, no, that's not your words, but you know, but you know, I think these are movies that are going to be close to their heart, and I don't think you find a filmmaker around who'll turn down Star Wars, to be honest.
Apart from Wes Anderson,
we'll never know.
Who was it you turned down? Was it David Lynch who turned down Star Wars? Is that right?
Did he turn it down? Did he ever get offered the gig officially?
Cronenberg
turned down Beverly Hills Cop and Flashdance. That's one of my favorite stories about David Cronenberg. I'd love to see David Cronenberg's Beverly Hills Cop. Can you imagine he's inserted the banana in the tailpipe and it just starts fusing, turns into a giant penis? That would be really weird.
I'm actually stuck on David Cronenberg's Flashdance. What would pour down when she pulls on the lever?
I would like to say, like, I know the point you're making, and I do understand your point you're making, but if somebody homogenous did Star Wars, that would just break my heart. Like, I know what you're saying. Hey,
get out.
Hey, first of all, you're English, and we hate that. No, it's difficult to argue with what you've just said. I feel like it's exciting, and to be honest, I thrive on the excitement more than the actual films. I can't remember the last time I actually watched a film, but I do like getting excited about them. So just give me that, okay?
The one about The National, you remember? You were there?
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I saw that.
That was good fun.
You
should review it in the podcast one of these days.
I should, yeah.
Sorry, Phil.
I was going to say, not every one of those sorts of directors that you mentioned wants to necessarily do those big films, I think. Shane Carruth, who did Upstream Colour, which was mind-bending, and Primer, which was a little bit Rian Johnson-y in its kind of time travel, but loopery. We asked him on the podcast if he had any interest in doing those sorts of Hollywood things, and he was just flat out no. I think there's a lot of filmmakers that are happy doing what they do. But yeah, I think that's a good point that Chris makes, that there was a generation of filmmakers that grew up with the movie brats films, the Scorsese's and Friedkin's, etc., Bogdanovich's, and now you're into the next generation, young filmmakers who grew up with the blockbusters that kind of we grew up with.
But I also I think they grew up with the Bogdanoviches as well. I think you know, David Lowery, for example, who did End in Body Saints, is a huge Star Wars fan. But he also could probably tell you chapter and verse by Peter Bogdanovich as well. So that's why I think it's really interesting that we have this new wave of filmmaker now who can mesh those sensibilities.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we're going to get some great films.
I would point out that Rian Johnson actually consulted, didn't he, with Shane Carruth on Looper.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, I want you to imagine for a moment that he does the same with Star Wars. There we've got something that's definitely not homogenous.
I think Shane Carruth could explain midichlorians.
Yes, this
come
would
from
be
pigs.
Amazing.
It's orchids which transplant their blueness into a pig, which is then siphoned into a human.
Yeah.
And that's why I can think
it's
things
the pig
upwards.
Pig blood, which explains the Gamorrean guards, and then, oh my god, everything's beginning to make sense. This is huge, guys, huge. By the way, Nick Desemlian has been sending me texts for the last 5 minutes saying, first of all, how's the podcast going? I said, it's okay. Are you on stage now? Are you reading out my texts? I will, I said. Send something. So Nick Desemlian texted me, big penis.
Was that his question?
That's it.
Yeah, no, it was the actual text. It wasn't a picture of a big penis.
Was it big penis question mark?
Big, no, exclamation mark. Big penis! So maybe he's been startled by a big penis back in the office.
Maybe he's on Tinder and hit the wrong button. Has it?
There's a button for big penis?
Any other questions for us? Yes, please, sir. Wait for the microphone, please, if you can. It's racing round.
If this doesn't involve penises, it's not gonna fly.
We've gone way off the...
Hopefully it doesn't involve penises.
Hello, Pod.
Hello.
Hello.
This is sort of my suggestion as a missed lunch, but on the subject of chef and food porn, what do you think are some of the best culinary scenes in cinema?
All of Big Night.
Yeah, all of Big Night, yeah.
All of Big Night, that's true. I would actually also mention Waitress. I don't know if anyone here has seen it. So it's kind of a little tiny film. Kerry Russell stars as a waitress. Kerry Russell? Yes. Mm-hmm. Stars as a waitress who bakes pies. And she bakes different pies according to her mood, and they're all actually really plot-sensitive pies, but they also look amazing.
Plot-sensitive pie. Okay.
But they also look amazing. And again, I went into a screening on an empty stomach and sat there regretting it for 2 hours or 90 minutes or whatever it is. The pies look exceptionally good. And I'm usually a cake person. I'm not like Dean Winchester. And they looked incredible.
I don't think
there were like three Supernatural fans in the audience who thought it was really funny.
I got that. There's not a single person here, I don't think, who's seen Goodfellas and hasn't seen the scene where they cook the amazing pasta dish in prison and not wanted to go to jail. Ideally with some mafiosos, because that would be amazing. That film just makes me hungry. Every time I watch it, it's great.
Labor Day. Have you seen Labor Day? It comes up every week. My brother's obsessed with how wrong the scene is. And so am I, because it's just awful. It's just, it's kind of, they're making a peach, what is it, a peach cobbler?
I think they were making a plot-sensitive pie.
Plot-sensitive pie. That's right. They'd run out
of plot. It's a thing.
Yeah. And it's Josh Brolin, Kate Winslet together, doing this sort of erotic kind of massaging of the peaches. And a small child also in the scene. And
who goes in the pie.
Oh, no. Yeah, they massage. No.
Titus Andronicus, no.
I would also mention Butterbeer, which I was lucky enough to recently try.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like the best hangover cure ever. It's just like, if you actually try it, if you go to the resorts that have it, almost solid ice-ish caramelly coffee gulp up to about here, and then it's just a chunk, maybe a solid disc of cream. I challenge anyone to finish it. It's one of those drinks that pushes you so far back into sober that you need to be drunk first to have it, because it is such a fierce drink, and it costs $8.
Where did you go?
I got to last week, but I got to see the new Diagon Alley over in Universal Studios Florida in Orlando, and it is the most amazing place. It's four streets. You know how people joke that Harry Potter, oh, it's just like England? I was just like walking around Borough Market. Oh, that building looks old. There are buildings that are old, and they all look like this. Not to ruin it too much, but you can actually buy wands, and then there are signs on the floor, and you do this incantation like a Wii remote, and you can do like up, obviously you know what this means, great radio. And it will make an umbrella above you, which you didn't realize was above you, rain on top of you, over you. And then this, it's just incredible. It's just an incredible experience. I really do recommend it. But my God, the butterbeer is off the chain.
I had some slightly closer to home. I had some in Watford at the studio tour. I don't know why they serve it in tankards, because you can drink that much.
Yeah.
That's how much you can drink.
A shot.
They should genuinely put it in shot glasses. It could be like teetotaler shots.
I remember when I was on set of X-Men Days of Future Past.
I think it's probably time to take a next question.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I just drifted off there in a reverie. What's happening?
I think we have been given the bat signal.
We have been given the bat signal. We've got time for a couple more questions, just a couple more. There's a hand up right at the back. You can see the hand, sir. Yeah, in fact, there's two people, and we'll go to you for the last question then. Great.
Hi there. I heard a rumour that you were once on the set of X-Men Days of Future Past.
I can't confirm or deny that at this particular time, but yes, I was. It was awesome.
I was wondering, what's the most boring set visit you've ever done?
Oh, my God. I was on set of a film called The Best Man that never got released in cinemas. And we just sat around in trailers all day in London, in near West Ham Stadium.
I've been on some extraordinarily boring sets. I'm not going to name the film in question because I haven't written it yet, but the worst thing that can possibly happen is when you go on a big action movie and you end up watching someone open the door for like 12 hours, which has happened, or you're stuck in a room with other journalists who are the worst for ages. One of my very first visits, my first abroad was on Heart's War. And I didn't see any filming. I flew to Prague and I didn't see a single bit of filming. Not one. And we were stuck in a tent for like 10 hours. Bruce Willis wouldn't come and talk to us because he's Bruce Willis. He doesn't do that type of thing. And luckily Colin Farrell turned up and he was great. But I've had experiences like that. You go to Godsend. I went to Godsend, which is a dreadful horror film in Toronto. And that was, again, just stuck in a room. And you know that Robert De Niro is outside doing really Robert De Niro-y things. He's probably becoming a vending machine or whatever it is that he does. You know, he uses his powers of method to become things. I read in a book. And on that bombshell, that is it for our second experiment in grueling terror, a Second Life podcast. Hope you guys enjoyed it. The regular podcast, pre-recorded podcast, will return next week. This one's going to go up on Friday, so you can listen to this and edit it actually making sense once it goes up on Friday-ish. Hopefully we're going to do more of these down the line. Who knows where we'll turn up? Who knows? Maybe in a street being sick with Sean Bean. Who knows? But join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Keira Knightley, who's going to be talking about Begin Again, and Richard Linklater, the brilliant Richard Linklater, talking about his new film Boyhood, which I haven't seen, but I hear is brilliant. Is it brilliant, guys? Brilliant. Fantastic. Until then, it is goodbye from Ali.
Bye.
It is goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Farewell.
And it's goodbye from me. And thank you so much for coming, guys. We literally could not do this without you. We'll see you next time. And it is, as I believe they say up here in Scotland, I checked this on Duolingo, goodbye from me. See you next time. Bye-bye.